The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower & Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and we are also on federalnewsradio.com. I'm here today with Steve Charles of the Immix Group and Harold Good, formerly of Frederick County, Maryland, the procurement executive, and Harold went off on his own 2 years ago. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Harold, let's start with you, because this is your first time on the show. So give us your background and your current position, please.
Well, I started out in hospital purchasing in New York City. I worked for New York University Medical Center. And then I went on vacation to Palm Springs, California, and ended up working for Palm Springs for 21 years. And it was a beautiful place to work. And I worked for Sonny Bono for 4 years. And that was a great place to kind of get great generalist background in public procurement, because it's a big little city. What I mean by that is it has a convention center and an international airport and all those things. So we did a lot of things. We had to do them right the first time, and a lot of them weren't duplicated down the road. So after Palm Springs, I spent 7 years working in Frederick County, Maryland. And since then, I've been doing consulting and advisory services.
Okay. Stephen?
So Jeff Copeland and I formed Immix Group about 17 and a half years ago to help OEMs and software publishers go to market in the public sector. And prior to that, I was helping companies get and maintain schedule contracts, which, as we all know, have been open now, some of them open to state and local procurements. So we've been operating in this world of cooperative agreements for more than a decade, knitting together public sector go-to-market strategies for OEMs that include federal, state, and local. So I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, and that's the overall theme for today, cooperative purchasing, state and local governments. ONVIA will be coming out shortly with a report that indicates 2013 spending at state and local government was down, I think, somewhere around 5%. It may level off. That was for 2013. It may level off in 2014, but overall, the squeeze is on. So, Harold, you've been doing this a long time. So, give me a brief history of cooperative purchasing agreements and why they started.
Well, I think cooperative purchasing agreements started, and they result in a benefit to the buyer and the seller, and I'll kind of concentrate on the buyer side. For public agencies, there's always seems to be a shortage of personnel, and when you go out with a competitive process, it's very time consuming to do it right. So if you don't have to do a individual process for everything you buy, that's a big gain in terms of productivity and in basically being able to limit your staff to what seems to be possible in today's world and has been that way for a long time. The other advantage to a public agency in terms of doing cooperative procurements is the fact that you get a better price because you combine your buying power with those of other public agencies. And coincidentally, there's over 80,000 public agencies in the United States that are eligible to do cooperative purchasing. So if you look at the combined clout and buying power of those, if they combine their buying power to buy things such as office supplies or equipment, vehicles, it's tremendous. And it's a win-win because they can buy things more efficiently, they can buy it cheaper, and they can kind of pick and choose which contracts they want to participate in. So from a buyer point of view, it's an ideal world.
Stephen, what's the advantage for vendors like Immix or a manufacturer, whoever?
Sure. So I'm always looking at the world from the OEM software publisher perspective. Those are the kinds of companies that we serve. And from that perspective, the most important thing is getting the terms and conditions lined up. Less important for hardware, but very important for anything that's intellectual property based. So software agreements, so that they are consistent across an OEM or a software publisher's ecosystem, is really important for them. They want to know that their licensing terms are consistent. And so leveraging these vehicles with partners who participate with them on their behalf at the local level, where everything is consistent, so that we're not renegotiating things every deal, helps cut down time on both the buy side and the sell side, requires less expertise on both sides. Business can move forward more efficiently. And so that's what got us into it, and that's what keeps us in it.
Okay. Harold, you've been in public purchasing for 30-plus years. When did cooperative purchasing emerge on your radar?
I think the first that it emerged in my radar was in the early 90s. And it was organizations such as WISCA that started buying pharmaceuticals and became very successful in that. And then they expanded. They started out in Minnesota, which had one of the toughest public procurement laws as far as what cooperative purchasing had to abide by. And therefore, those contracts that were originated in Minnesota were eligible for just about every agency that was open to cooperative purchasing to participate in. And then U.S. Communities and NASPO and NIGP got involved, and it started to become a phenomena because of the great savings involved, in both in terms of cost and in manpower.
Okay, you mentioned two organizations here, NASPO and NIGP. Let's do a little bit on what each is and what it does for our listeners, please. NASPO.
Okay, NASPO is the National Association of State Procurement Agents, and NASPO represents state purchasing in all 50 states. And so they come out with white papers on best practices that are beneficial to all public purchasing at the state level, and they concentrate primarily at that level. National Institute of Governmental Purchasing has been active as a partner, a collegial partner with NASPO on state purchasing, but NIGP has been kind of the agency over the years that addresses training, cooperative purchasing, coordination, all sorts of things that are really of interest to state and local government purchasing agents. And they also originated the certification program for certified public procurement agents and for professional buyers that has kind of become the standard in public purchasing in the United States and increasingly broader across national lines.
Okay, didn't NASPO used to do an annual conference? Is that still around?
NASPO and NIGP both do national conferences.
Okay. Are those beneficial for vendors to attend, Stephen?
Well, I know that we always try to have someone go to the NASPO conference. Mm-hmm. They also publish a textbook that I find very useful. I keep it on my shelf, and it's got all kinds of stickies poking out of it.
Yeah. I understand that. Tab that sucker.
Yeah.
Did you write any of that book, Al?
I hopefully contributed some to the process, but I didn't actually write any of it.
Okay. We're going to take our first break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guests today are Hal Good, a consultant, a longtime public procurement official, and now available for consulting work. You can find Hal on LinkedIn, and I suggest you do. And then my other guest is Steve Charles of the Immix Group. You can find him at immixgroup.com or on LinkedIn. Stephen, the cooperative purchasing agreements are extremely attractive as broad-based vehicles for the community. But it's not exactly something one should enter into lightly.
Well, very true. Very true. We're talking about contracts here that involve multiple parties. It's a little more complex than a simple buy-sell transaction. We're talking about someone setting up a contract that then other people can use. And so it brings up questions of who are these parties? What is their relationship? How do we audit those relationships? How do we handle disputes? And increasingly, parties want data about what's going on between the parties, you know, from the manufacturer on through the distribution channel, through the contract vehicle, and then ultimately to the end user. So this multi-party arrangement and the fact that there are now data flows that people want to track is something that we've developed a product around. We call it Public Sector Insight, and it is designed to help OEMs and software publishers go to market, create productive channels, and work in a compliant way within these complex contracting structures.
Okay. So give me some advantages to playing here for a manufacturer. Actually, let's look at it a different way. What's the advantage of a manufacturer not, you know, I don't recommend manufacturers hold their own GSA schedules. Never, ever, ever. I always suggest they use an aggregator or at least a significant player as far as Avara is concerned. There's not too many of those. So fairly limited gene pool.
Sure. So, and part of the reason that's the common recommendation is because many times the manufacturers really don't understand what's involved in staying compliant with such contracts. Wall Street also rewards companies for outsourcing anything that's not core. And so Wall Street rewards companies who can build and enable a channel downstream, who can get closer to the customer more efficiently. And one of those functions that is typically outsourced to the channel is holding and maintaining contracts. We got into cooperative purchasing when GSA opened up the schedules to allow state and local participation under the contracts. And getting back to this multi-party thing, the approach there is that, yes, we have a contract with the General Services Administration, but it is the terms and conditions of the order itself and the relationship between the orderer and the order taker that is the basis for the contractual action and the basis for any kind of dispute resolution should such an event occur downstream. But some of the other vehicles are structured a little differently, and I know Hal has a lot of experience with them, so I think it's time for him to talk a little.
I think on the buyer side, one of the most important things, it really relates to what you're talking about, and that is the complexity. Because you have to have a very sophisticated agency in terms of the documents that they put out, the terms and conditions that you referenced, and accurately describing a scope of services or a product specification in order to have it be universally acceptable for other agencies other than the originator to participate in. And the expectations have to be match across the line. If you're looking for something and you're looking at someone else's contract, you want to know exactly that that fits your needs. And so describing what it is that's on that cooperative contract is very important. Let's look at something as simple that everyone in the world uses, and that's office supplies. On office supplies, the national office supply contracts right now have access to at least 5,000 items that are individually priced, and then a price formula for pricing the other ones that are less used. And it takes someone that has significant usage and diversity in their own uses to be able to put a contract like that out in the street. But those contracts are very complex, and they typically, to be advantageous to everyone, have to cover all the different things that every type of agency that you can imagine would utilize.
Okay. So on the office supply side, GSA chose the office supply schedule as their first strategic sourcing initiative. It is not one of the vehicles that is open to state and local, But oftentimes state and local will use, or they used to use, GSA pricing as kind of a baseline and then ask for a better deal. So that's available on the federal side. I'm assuming both WSCA and U.S. communities have office supplies. What kind of overlap is there between some of the cooperative purchasing agreements? Is there a lot?
Well, there's overlap in terms of the national companies that deal in office supplies. Typically, someone like NASPO and WSCA will have a contract with one entity, and U.S. communities will have in another. And so typically, there's a cooperative contract probably available for all of the major national players, which is interesting because then a public agency can look at those and look at their needs versus the contracts that are available and pick and choose the one that's best for them. So they can actually use that as a way of choosing what's the best value for them in their situation. And from my experience, the best office supply contract in one region of the country or for one type of agency that has a high use in, say, different types of products versus somebody that has a use in other types of products or is in a different region is very different. And the service of those companies is very different because they have regional outlets, and sometimes the price is almost identical, and it boils down to someone picking and choosing in terms of the diversity of the products available and the service support.
Okay. So when you say the big players, are you talking like Office Depot's on one and Staples is on the other?
Yeah, those are the two largest.
Right. Yeah, I just wasn't sure if you were talking about the resellers or the actual manufacturers, because those are probably Chinese companies. So, you know,
it really depends on the industry.
That's
true. Each industry is really organized differently.
Yeah.
And it's something that continues to maintain my interest, understanding how each industry goes to market, the channels of distribution and the channel economics all play into this and really do manifest themselves differently at the contract vehicle level, one industry to another.
Okay. So, Steve, let's go back to the kind of overlapping thing here. IMIX, number one, offers a variety of contractual vehicles for your manufacturing partners. Last count I think I had was 20 or close to 20 different contracts, maybe more. And several of those were the cooperative agreements. How do you select? What's your process for selecting the cooperative agreement for your partners?
So our approach is a little different than most. We've always aligned ourselves with a manufacturer. A manufacturer hires us to come up with a go-to-market plan. And if we are the contract holder or someone else is the contract holder, that's all based on that manufacturer's strategy. So there are situations where we are participating as the contract holder, and in other situations where we're just managing the contract and the manufacturer itself is the holder, or some other partner is the holder. In fact, some of these cooperative agreements require the OEM be the contractor. And so they have to set up the vehicle to then facilitate the participation of downstream partners. If the OEM has to be the contract holder, they must set it up in a way that local partners can participate. And that was actually the beginning of our Public Sector Insight product, being able to keep all of that data and those contractual actions lined up and auditable after the fact. So we play different roles depending on what the OEM requires, what the OEM asks us to do. So in some cases, we're holding contract directly. In other cases, we're participating under it. In other cases, we're just providing an administrative function.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts on that, Hal? Or?
I think the whole idea of the OEM complexities, maybe a real case scenario would be helpful for people to understand some of the advantages we're talking about. Let's take defibrillators. Defibrillators, we all know, are life-saving, and more they're available with people with the training to basically help people whose heart is stopped, and you know, they can still be salvaged if someone knows what they're doing, but time is of the essence. Well, different manufacturers of defibrillators have different training processes. And one of the advantages of cooperative purchasing is if you're in a region and you have a hospital and ambulance services and all kinds of emergency services, fire departments and so forth in that region, you can standardize using cooperative purchasing, de facto standardize, and all be able to tie into the same contract, use the same manufacturer's defibrillator. Then you have the standardized training. There's a tremendous advantages of that beyond price and manpower in terms of actual end result, the desired end result of saving lives. Another quick example is we've all seen examples of communication systems that were incompatible in an emergency situation. Counties can all use the same radio system by using a cooperative contract and working with each other and ensure compatibility of what they buy, not having to go out and simply take the low bid. And if the low bid happens to not be compatible with what their neighbor has, then you get this disconnect where there's an emergency on the borders and they can't talk to each other, or the fire department can't talk to the police department, and all those things that have happened in the past. And we all know horror cases where that's happened. Cooperative purchasing provides a vehicle to standardize those regionally and between departments.
Okay, we're going to take a break. My guests today are Steve Charles of the MX Group and Hal Good. Again, you can find them both on LinkedIn. I'm Mark Amtower. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM back after these messages. Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guests are Hal Good and Steve Charles, and we're talking about cooperative purchasing agreements. As I mentioned during the break, I have run a variety of Google Alert programs for a number of clients, one of which is furniture. So I have a Google Alert for government furniture. I've gotten an alert exactly twice in the 8 or plus years that I've had this particular alert. But the first one was an announcement in North Carolina that indicated that state money for furniture had to be spent on North Carolina furniture and North Carolina vendors. Going back to your point in the last segment, Hal, there's a lot of efficiencies for standardizations, but how does local preference tie into all of this?
Sure. Well, in state and local, it is about local presence, and it does extend to local preference. The OEMs, the manufacturers, really need to be setting up their channels of distribution with all of this in mind. And small businesses need to leverage their role and be thinking about how they can add value in their particular locale or with their particular expertise. You know, in the case of furniture, it might be local delivery and maybe not delivery anymore since so much of this stuff is drop shipped, but really more the installation and integration because now furniture is part of smart systems. But again, it goes back to the manufacturer. On the domestic preference side, the local preference side, you talked about the North Carolinians and furniture, you know, we could probably identify some of that at all levels of government. You know, for many years, the federal government had a preference for furniture that was manufactured by the prison industries, mm-hmm. right? Similar.
Except they never really manufactured it. All they did was repaint it.
I don't know what they did. All I know is that the buyers were supposed to look at their furniture first before moving
right.
further. And I
yeah.
suspect that's how it is in North Carolina in this case. So manufacturer preference, local preference is not just at the production level, though. It is also then extends to who is the last hand that that item is touched before the customer takes title or before it's installed and turned over. And that is the place where local participation is key. And cooperative agreements can be set up to facilitate that engagement, that participation. And again, that's what we focus on at MX, where everyone is playing to their strengths, everyone is adding value, and the supply chain is getting more efficient.
I think that the national manufacturers that are smart are always on the outlook to see how they can involve local merchants and local corporations somehow in the process, because that takes down a lot of the resistance from someone buying, say, in the Midwest from some national manufacturer and not having any kind of a role or payback with dollars in their local community. On the subject of like protectionism and or preference, steel on a national level is one that has been there historically. And one can understand the state like North Carolina wanting to protect their furniture business. But in today's world, those kind of preferences are fraught with some unintended consequences, because a lot of states and a lot of agencies have what's called a reciprocal preference. And a reciprocal preference, in simple words, is if we're buying something from a locale that has a preference against our manufacturers or our local vendors, then automatically, in like amount, we impose one against them. So if you have a local preference, you have to look at it really closely, because lots of times those tend to be more negative in terms of results for the local company that the intentions were to protect because of the reciprocal preference. Say, just for the sake of discussion, the other 49 states all had reciprocal preferences. Many of them do. Okay. So are you getting enough of business from your own state to make up for the loss of business in those other states that have the reciprocal preference? And in many cases, the answer to that is no. And in many cases, the people that put those preferences in place are asked by the people who they were trying to help to please take them off, because they're not helping, they're hurting.
I think our economy has become much more, both our channels of distribution from the manufacturer's perspective and our supply chains from a buyer perspective have, of necessity, become much more data-driven. Virtual warehousing is something that informs this new world of cooperative agreements, so that we can put in place contractually ways in which multiple parties participate, from the manufacturer straight on through to the end customer, possibly involving two or three hops along the way. Hops that used to be physical, title taking, title transfer, but today are not. They're purely contractual, and they are data driven. And so for us, this represents a real opportunity to become more efficient in the supply chain, but still involve local business in ways in which local business and small business can actually add value. Okay. And I'm not sure if we want to talk about some of that in terms of what you've seen at the local level, Hal, where small business actually played a value-added role.
Yeah, you've been in, what, at least three significant smaller agencies. What impact does small have there? I mean, you know, Palm Springs or Frederick, whatever.
Well, taking off from what I was talking about a little while ago in communication systems, maybe specifically radio systems, the big towers and the networks for communication of necessity have to be in national companies such as maybe Motorola. But on the local level, the service of the equipment that's used by the emergency services people, or the maintenance people, or all the people that are end users of a system like that, those things can be supported and serviced on a local level. And in fact, in terms of response time and in terms of communication and friendliness and responding to the needs, which sometimes are unique in those situations, the national supplier just really is a lot less able to deal with that effectively than the local guys that get to know everybody and get to know the environment and what the specific needs are. And that's just one example. But I think that that gets duplicated many, many times in terms of an advantage. One of the things I like to think about is what we do in our everyday lives and its applicability to what we're talking about. And most of us probably shop in a big box in terms of groceries or appliances or something like that. But probably all of us also patronize local stores. And what's the difference? If we're going into a delicatessen, a local delicatessen, we're probably looking for something very different than we're looking at when we're walking into the huge chain. And those things usually boil down to service and value-added things that sometimes are intangible. Maybe it's just somebody that recognizes what you typically buy and say, you know what, I just got this in, I think you'd be interested. The national company isn't going to do that.
Yeah, but you're running across a lot of regulations when it comes to public procurement that preclude going to that smaller local buyer that may have, you know, the relationship and something that they know should be of interest to the buyer, but there's currently, you know, maybe no vehicle from which to purchase it.
Yeah, but some of these cooperative agreements, the way they're set up where maybe the OEM is the contractor or maybe a distributor is the contractor, and they are set up designed to facilitate the participation of local dealers as participants. And that's where local business can plug in. I know it's different from one industry to another, but I know that in our industry, in the world of IT, we are always running programs where downstream local business can be involved in the transaction and is then in a better position to provide the downstream ongoing service opportunity.
Okay. We're going to take a break. My guests today are Hal Good and Steve Charles. I'm Mark Amtower. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Back after these. Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guests today are Steve Charles of the Immix Group and Hal Good, a procurement professional with massive experience at the state and local level. Hal, there are a lot of cooperative purchasing agreements, some of which focus in on very narrow offerings, like the Houston Galveston vehicle. Give us a little background on that, please.
Well, Houston Galveston is a very interesting co-op and very beneficial to public agencies in the fact that they deal with large equipment and big ticket items. And Houston Galveston co-op started out with fire trucks. In the typical small fire department in a smaller jurisdiction, will go out to bid for a fire truck and they'll get a discount on the fire truck. But in today's world, there's all sorts of ancillary equipment that goes on that truck. Very sophisticated ancillary equipment. And so typically they get the discount on the fire truck, but they'd pay list price with all the add-ons. The Houston Galveston co-op quickly grew into representing the combined needs of so many agencies starting in Texas and then becoming national that they ended up having the leverage to get discounts on all the possible things you could think of that are add-ons and ancillary equipment. And then they went beyond fire trucks and involved all kinds of other heavy equipment, the kind of snow removal equipment in airports and Oshkosh and all those sorts of things. So they're kind of the go-to agency in terms of cooperative purchasing today. Interestingly enough, all the employees that work for the Houston Galveston Co-op are public employees, and that is a public agency of itself. It's not a city or a county, but it qualifies as a public agency, and all their employees are public. So everything they do qualifies as being originated in a public agency, and several co-ops are structured that way. But the Houston Galveston model is kind of an example. I talked about the one that started as just pharmaceuticals and became nationally in a very diversified base. Houston Galveston now finds themselves having to expand their line to meet demands of their customers because in today's world, emergency equipment now has all kinds of sophisticated built-in geo-based equipment. And that sort of thing. So they're actually venturing into the high-tech line of necessity because of the fact that those things are now carried in that type of equipment. And And Steve might want to expand on that.
Well, they're actually a channel for a lot of information technology. It's all intellectual property based. It's IP protocol based, as well as some radio based stuff. And because of that, it becomes a matter of a cybersecurity issue too, which gets to another dimension of this whole thing of a supply chain, where end customers need to have some assurance that's what's coming in from the manufacturers through the various channels is legitimate. We have a big issue in federal and state and local procurement around IP-based products that are counterfeit or have been tampered with. And so these cooperative agreements increasingly are being structured so that we know who the players are, so that we have what the feds refer to as a secure supply chain. And it's in law that we have documented the hops from the original OEM straight through to the end customer. And these cooperative agreements are contractual frameworks that can facilitate that kind of assurance and auditability. And that's the end of the world that we live in at IMIX.
Okay.
One of the interesting maybe things to note in that is in Europe, it's interesting that controlling risk in supply chain really got driven when all the horse meat started showing up in restaurants and people didn't know they were buying horse meat. And that triggered the revolution and all the other things that they're looking at. And risk management in supply chain has become the big buzzword and the big emphasis in securing that in Europe. And it's kind of ironic that it started with something like that. But it definitely is becoming very, very important and recognized as very important in the supply chain in the United States. Because just as Steve said, you have to know whether those things are really what they claim to be. And so many of them in today's world where you're just dealing with an IPA address are turning out not to be. So that's a very big issue in today's world.
This new world where we have agreements that involve multiple parties, that span multiple industries, serving multiple jurisdictions, from manufacturers straight on through to end customers who are part of publicly funded activities in all different parts of the country is a complex web. And so I just want to make sure people understand that, and that there are folks who are thinking this all through and are figuring out how to manage and monitor all the data flows associated with that, so that these kinds of complex agreements actually work well and allow all the participants to play to their strengths and add value through to the end customer.
Okay. Wrap up, Hal?
I think one of the other things that's become or is growing rapidly in today's world is spend analytics. And that is looking at what you're spending money for and then using that data, the data that Steve was alluding to that you generate, and look at analyzing your history and how you can do better on that, but also predictively how you can use that data to in your marketing effort, in your quality control effort, in your risk management effort, and all those different things. And that's one of the complex items that's really becoming significant in supply chain in today's world.
Okay, final thoughts, Stephen?
Well, it is all about the data. And this public sector insight tool that we've developed is about managing that from the OEM out, because those end customers are increasingly asking for data. It's not just supply chain risk management, it's also strategic sourcing, it's also all about the data. And from a seller's perspective, we want to understand who is selling at what and where we have efficiencies in our channels of distribution, just like the buy side wants to understand the efficiencies in their supply chain. It's all the same data.
Cool. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Harold Good, Hal Good, is a consultant in this arena. So if you're a manufacturer looking to understand this, I would suggest you find him on LinkedIn, give him a call. Steve Charles Company deals primarily in the information technology arena with OEMs. They have a stable of contracts and a stable of other companies that they support. So both resellers and manufacturers. So I suggest you look them both up. This is not my day job. If you need advice and direction on marketing to the government, give me a call. And if you need help leveraging social media to reach out to either side of the communities, the buyers or the sellers, I'm your guy. So thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.